Hey, Kirsty Melville here, and today a cracking story about folk music, protest, politics and sedition, all set during the Vietnam War. Many years ago in London, Earshot producer Gary Bryson found a cassette in a box of old tape recordings that had been made by BBC producer Charles Parker. Parker was famous for the highly acclaimed series of radio ballads that he made in the 1950s and 60s with the folk musicians Ewan McColl and Peggy Seeger. But the cassette tape wasn't a radio ballad. It was labelled Off Limits No. 2 and dated 1970, the height of the Vietnam War. It featured American draft evaders, discontented soldiers and deserters, and its tone was anti-war and anti-establishment. It's probably not that surprising, as Parker was a self-proclaimed Maoist. What was surprising, though, was that Off Limits had been made not for the BBC, but as propaganda for the North Vietnamese. Gary's been fascinated by this chance find and the politics of that protest ever since. And so here he is, tracking down some of the people involved.
The program that follows is made in London, England. You'll be hearing people giving views and experiences who are not actors, simply people dissatisfied with the way things are in America or in Vietnam. And the people who made this program are likewise not professionals. They're simply people trying to understand the mechanisms that have taken you halfway around the world.
I never knew Charles Parker. That's his voice you just heard. The famous BBC radio producer, and this was still a time when radio producers could be famous, was best known for the radio ballads, a series of documentaries he made in the 50s and 60s with the folk musicians Ewan McColl and Peggy Seeger. Go down. Kicked on the earth and the world split open,
crawled through a crack. We shall. Nearly half of all non-white housing in the United States has no
I met Parker much later on. In the late 1970s, he was a frequent guest lecturer to students studying journalism at the Polytechnic of Central London. He was middle-aged, tall and red-faced. He always wore a shirt and tie under a V-neck jumper, a tweed sports jacket and grey flannels. There was nothing to suggest to the casual onlooker that Parker was a Marxist, let alone a Maoist, though the BBC had by then disowned him.
Sure, you got freedom to get shot, you got freedom to die for your country.
When he died in 1980, I was briefly involved in the setting up of the Charles Parker Archive. Parker had left behind reels and reels of recordings, all of which had to be sorted and categorised. My role in this was insignificant, merely involving a box of tapes left in the care of the Polytechnic.
This is my first sign of blood.
There were interesting unedited interviews made for early programmes when the portable tape recorder was new technology. There were some copies of more well-known documentaries and some disappointingly blank tapes. But there was one particular tape that stood out from the rest. It was a cassette, and the yellowing label simply said,
Off Limits, a report from London to Vietnam.
Donald Henry, dead! Ralph Valencia, dead!
It's hard to explain it even now. But when I first heard this programme, one of a series of three, possibly four, I found myself drawn into a lost world. A world of political passion and commitment. Off Limits carried the echoes of a world at war. But a war that was never simply black and white, country against country, right or wrong. Because Charles Parker didn't make Off Limits for the BBC. He made it for the Viet Cong.
Far away across the ocean, far beyond this resistant rim, there's some man who is father of the Indochinese people, and his name it is Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh.
It was an attempt, I suppose, to spread dissension and doubt amongst American troops in Vietnam.
On the plains below, young and old workers present at the toilet, and farmers fight for freedom with Uncle Ho.
when a million people march against the Vietnam War in London, is that sedition? Or is it expression of public sentiment?
We were musicians and folk singers.
We all wanted North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong to succeed.
So how did a prominent BBC radio producer come to be making programmes for the Viet Cong? It all starts with folk music.
I am a jovial collier lad, as blithe can be. And let the times be good or bad, it's all the same to me. It's little of the world I know and care less for its ways. For where the dog star never glows, I wear away me days.
It may seem odd to associate folk music with radical left-wing politics, but the aftermath of World War II saw a revival of folk traditions, both in America and Britain. Here's Mike Brocken, senior lecturer in music at Liverpool Hope University and an historian of the British post-war folk revival.
As we came out of the Depression in the 1930s, people started to become more politicised and started to realise that there was indeed this tradition. So the left wing in particular, in the late 1930s, you know, people from the Labour movement, Fabians, the cooperative choirs, etc., started to evolve a kind of an interest in industrial song, and that pervaded itself through the war, but also started to gather momentum after the war.
Down in the coal mine underneath the ground, where a gleam of sunshine never can be found.
Up until the Hungarian uprising in the mid to late 50s, there were thousands and thousands of people who were paid up members of the Communist Party in Britain. So many people were left thinking and turned their attention east rather than west. So while we've got, you know, the rock and roll scene from the mid-50s and skiffle coming out of that and all of those really interesting things, we've got also at the same time this interest in preservation and representation. And a lot of that was sponsored, you know, financially sponsored by the left. There was a group of people called the Workers Music Association, and they were really a ginger group of the Communist Party at that stage. And people like Ewan McColl had a lot to do with all of that.
Oh dear me, the mill's gane fast, the pair wee shifters canny get a rest.
Ewan McColl is an important figure in our story, along with his partner, the American Peggy Seeger. He was one of the driving forces behind the British folk revival. His political views might best be described as uncompromising.
He was the first intellectual I ever met, actually. I'd never actually met anybody who'd sort of read loads of books and knew all this stuff about the history of theatre and the history of folk music. So he was a big influence.
Brian Pearson is a musician who worked with McColl in the 1960s.
He was a member of the Communist Party, which I think he left. Not as many people left the Communist Party because of things like the Hungarian invasion in 1956, but because he felt the Communist Party of Russia had gone soft. He disapproved of Khrushchev's reforms. So from there, he became a very enthusiastic Maoist and saw China as the kind of new beacon of hope for the world.
The old railway man, it was a tradition, it was part of your life. It went through, railways went through the back of your spine like Blackpool went through rock.
Charles Parker had worked with McColl and Peggy Seeger on the hugely successful Radio Ballads, which brought folk music and authentic voices together in new ways. McColl's influence on Parker was profound. Peggy Seeger remembers a man transformed.
Charles Parker was an amazing man. Well, when I began working with him, it would have been 1958, when he was working on the John Axon radio ballad. He was conservative, he was very religious. He believed totally in the upwardly mobile area that he was in. And he, when he started recording with Ewan McColl and we started making the radio ballads, Charles Parker literally became a new person.
When he got together with Ewan, his political opinions changed very rapidly and he became a very fervent Marxist, Leninist, Maoist, Ewan's probably most faithful disciple.
To transform yourself from a fairly narrow-minded, overly religious man into a left-wing, real fighter for justice and all those things that we give big generic names to, freedom, democracy, was amazing. He was an excellent man.
Brought up in New York City, where rats are big and cruel. You learned to block the kicks and shouts and fight your way through school. You went to church on Sunday, the preacher made you kneel, and thanked the Lord for giving you the price of half a meal.
The white man took the world and gave the Negro Jesus.
You worked your way through high school, the man looked at your face.
When I first heard Peggy, Peggy particularly, because that's the American music that I was just in love with, I went to the traditional side rather than the commercial side right away. I loved the source music. I loved what Peggy was doing with it.
In the 1960s, Jack Warshaw was a young American studying architecture in London and an aspiring folk musician. When his draft notice came up, he made the decision not to return home. He became a draft evader.
10,000 miles from home.
You were faced with a choice. What would you do if you had a gun put in your hands? Could you possibly believe in this? And I was already far, far along the path of not believing it. In fact, I hadn't believed in it since I started demonstrating at my university in the early 1960s about missiles and things. So it was really easy to make the choice to resist the war and go on from there. I was eventually declared a fugitive from justice when I didn't turn up, and subject to arrest if I went back.
This will make it necessary to increase our active fighting forces by raising the monthly draft call.
And from Pleiku, 25 miles away, a South Vietnamese relief
column. The outskirts of the village of Cam Ni with elements of the 1st Battalion 9th Marines. And we were walking into this village when...
Fervently anti-war, Jack Warshaw was drawn to the music of Seeger and McCall. At that time, they were to be found at the Singers Club in the Holborn district of central London.
I just turned up at the Singers Club. That was the place. That was the premier club in all of Britain, let alone London. I knew they were there, so I went there and reintroduced myself, and it all took off from there.
On the 16th day of August 1819, a meeting held in Peter Street was glorious to be seen.
The Singers Club was also home to the legendary Critics Group. It sought to develop new artistic and political standards for folk music performance.
With Henry Hunt we'll go, me boys, with Henry Hunt we'll go. We'll mount the cap of liberty in spite of Nading Joe.
We instigated a rule that when you're on the stage, you sing songs that come from your own culture. And this was quite revolutionary at the time because, you know, I was singing French songs. There was a guy who came along and sang songs from the Spanish Civil War in Spanish. And it was a kind of a free-for-all. So the Critics Group was formed to try and find a singing style, an accompanimental style, and an attitude towards folk music that would facilitate as truthful a rendition as possible.
The Critics Group was a group which really met to study folk song style and to improve our singing and performance skills. That was the primary aim of the thing. But because we were all fairly left-wing, we got involved in the whole Vietnam War thing very quickly.
By the late 1960s and early 70s, arguably, the Critics Group section of the folk scene had kind of retreated back into its manuscripts somewhat. Not just musical ones, but certainly political manuscripts. So that one end of the folk revival was very, very tightly engaged because there was a lot of support, not necessarily for North Vietnam, but there was a lot of support in the UK of getting the American direct involvement out of Vietnam.
Time and again, a solid wedge of militant troublemakers charged the police lines. They met a hard defensive wall.
We were at the Grosvenor Square demonstrations in 68 and whatever.
It was a very extraordinary kind of era, the 1960s, I guess. You know, all sorts of things were happening.
The kind of protest that we were doing was never given a lot of media attention. We operated at grassroots level on purpose. We didn't give huge concerts with great lineups and lots of microphones and that kind of thing. We did folk clubs. We traveled around under the wire.
They think if they snap their fingers, you'll come running like a dog. Black or white, to them you're just the same. So just like the Vietnamese, you'd better get up off your knees. Better learn to stand together, better wise up to their game.
By the late 1960s, the Critics Group was at the forefront of a folk music scene that was anti-war, anti-capitalist, and actively campaigning for a Viet Cong victory in Vietnam. This then sets the stage for the making of the radio series, Off Limits.
Ewan McCall wanted us to engage not just by means of singing at concerts and benefits and marching and things like that, but actually contributing musical ideas and sound ideas.
Listen, can you hear the rumble? Every morning, 3 a.m.
Ewan McCall had a connection with North Vietnam's unofficial Charge d'Affaires in London, a man called Noyn Van Sau.
I don't know how the connection came about. I mean, Ewan was a very political animal. He had all sorts of connections in left-wing circles, so it's not surprising that he came into contact with Noyn Van Sau.
At one of the meetings we had, we said, well, you know, what do you think we can do to help you? What we meant was be part of the liberation struggle. They simply said, well, anything you do is good. So, well, where were we? We were musicians and aspiring folk singers, and we were already performing, writing things.
They came from all walks of life.
But more from some than others.
From every corner of America.
But more from the poor corners.
They represented every race, color, and ethnic group.
But the people of the ghetto gave more of theirs.
The aim really was that these programs would be sent out to Vietnam and they'd be broadcast by Vietnamese radio to American troops, with the aim of persuading them that the war was not a good idea and that they should they should take action, really, of some sort or another. It was an attempt, I suppose, to spread dissension and doubt amongst American troops in Vietnam.
A farmhand from Kansas, a steelworker from Pittsburgh, a Negro janitor from Selma, an unemployed Puerto Rican from New York, New York. That's who they were. The ordinary fellow's always been the fall guy for big business and the military. But it's not your war. You're not going to be any richer after it.
So was it Charles Parker who first suggested making the Off Limits series? There's no doubt he had a great influence on the participants, and that the radio ballads were held up as a model, with their emphasis on authentic voices and music.
Probably the general shape of the programme was put together by Charles Parker, and a lot of the announcery bits, if I can put it that way, the kind of voiceover bits, were probably written and spoken by Charles.
Daily Express, 12th December. An American helicopter pilot claimed today that he challenged Lieutenant William Kelly to let him rescue the wounded. He said the confrontation was so hostile, he kept his guns trained on the American soldiers.
What you doing there in Vietnam, brother?
Charles, he was just incredible because he was supplying all the experience and knowledge and technique that he had invented for the radio ballads to this idea. We were all collecting press cuttings, we were all collecting material and getting ideas what to put into the program, what, you know, how to make a script and all this sort of thing, which Charles was teaching us. I had all these tapes, and of course you listened to them, you made notes, you took extracts from them, and you began to get ideas, just the way the radio ballads worked. You collected the actuality, and then you think about, well, you know, what can you do with that? What can you do by way of linking it, by writing lines of dialogue yourself, and what kind of songs should grow out of that?
Why should the war go on? Why should we kill, you know, other people, especially the black Americans?
Just to pass around a paper that contains a Bill of Rights. So
it was all done in Peggy and Ewan's front room, their living room come workroom. We set up the equipment. We recorded songs there. We made the speeches that form the text that we had written. I can't remember who wrote what, but I know I wrote some of it, and Charles wrote some of it, and some of it came from research texts that we spoke as actors. And, of course, there was the actuality to be fed in. We selected those bits. Charles produced it like he would any radio show. He took all these bits, and what came out was a script. So we were working to the script, and we were producing the parts of that script, which he would then record on the spot.
This little song that I'm saying about people you know, it's true. If you black and gotta work for a living now, this is what they will say to you. This is, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, whoa, brother, get back, get back, get back.
Charles Parker was still a BBC employee at the time when Off Limits was being made. Is it possible he used BBC facilities to mix and finish the programmes?
I can't verify, but it's highly likely that he did. It's the kind of thing that Charles would have done, yeah. I'm sure he would have nipped into the studios at night and used their tape editing facilities to put the programmes together, sure.
I don't think that they were finished in Ewan's living room. The final topping and tailing and stitching everything together and doing all the levels and all the technical bits that really only Charles knew how to do at the end. They had to be done someplace else. He probably just used whatever he could.
He facilitated, he used his position in the BBC to do things like Off Limits.
This is Grosvenor Square, November 15th, 1969. We're standing here witnessing a demonstration by several hundred people, including...
One day, I went down to Grosvenor Square. There was a demonstration in progress, which I'd heard about. And there were thousands of people there. And one by one, they were taking up lists of names of GIs who had been killed so far in the war and reading them out. And I just turned on my tape recorder. And I pointed the microphone, and I started to record these things. And then I started to record people that I met through that. And one of them turned out to be an ex-GI, and eventually we turned up an actual deserter from the forces.
Well, when I first came in to the service, I didn't know what I was really getting myself into, as many other GIs.
We asked him questions like, you know, what was it like killing people? He said he found it was very easy to kill people once you'd had a few of your friends killed and injured. He said it became not a difficult thing to do at all. He told us stories he'd been involved with taking Vietnamese prisoners up in the helicopter.
The first Vietnamese wouldn't say a word, so they chucked him out of the helicopter, 1,500 feet. The second one came flying out of the helicopter, also they threw him out.
Our boys wouldn't do that. Our boys wouldn't do that. For this is free America, and our boys wouldn't do that.
There was a platoon of GIs who massacred several hundred people, including babies and so forth. The My Lai massacre. This was the most notorious thing that occurred, I think, probably during the whole war. But some of those GIs that I talked to and that appear in the program, they described what they and their fellow soldiers actually did during the war. And, you know, there was a kind of news blackout and this sort of thing wasn't allowed to get out as much as it should have. But in Off Limits, it's all there and firsthand.
Come and listen and story I will tell of a young GI you will remember. He died in Vietnam in the Mekong Delta land. He had sandals on his feet and a rifle in his hand.
There was a fellow who used to come to the Singers Club. His name was Rod Shearman. And he came out with this song, which was based on a news clipping, or series of clippings, about some GIs who had kind of seen the light. And they'd changed sides, and they'd gone over and actually fighting for the liberation forces. And one of them was found dead, and he was wearing black pajamas, and this was reported. Nobody knew who he was, so he was the unknown soldier. I think I wrote the chorus to it.
I wonder what was his name. I wonder from which town he came. I wonder if his children will know the reason why, the way he had to fight and the way he had to die.
Off Limits sought to influence the hearts and minds of American soldiers. But the authorities of the day might have seen it very differently. As enemy propaganda. Sedition. Perhaps even treason.
I think that would be a difficult argument to sustain, with perhaps the exception of the Americans who were involved in the programs. The UK wasn't at war with Vietnam. There was no reason why we should not object to the war, and there was no reason really why we couldn't send material to Vietnam. I didn't think it was treasonable.
Well, I don't think America ever declared war against Vietnam. It's an illegal war. So who's acting seditiously here?
It occurred to me that somebody might hear it and consider it to be a treasonable offense. Well, what is the penalty, or what was the penalty for treason? We talked about it a bit, and then just left it, just thought, we need to go on with this.
You have been listening to Off Limits, a report from London to Vietnam.
Miền biển đông, xa góc nơi chân trời. Người dân ở đó lầm than đói nghèo.
I don't know to this day whether it actually happened, and if they got the programs, what they did with the programs.
Ewan certainly said they were broadcast at Van, and I also recall Ewan saying that he'd received a message from Ho Chi Minh himself thanking him for the programs. And it may well be true. On the other hand, Ewan did have a vivid imagination.
Off Limits was produced by Gary Bryson, and the sound engineer was Andrei Shabanov. I'm Kirsty Melville. This has been Earshot. Make sure you follow us on Facebook to keep up to speed with what's coming up and what we're listening to. If you like what we're doing, tell us. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.